This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Well, we're just about ready to put this year to bed, which means it's time to look back and talk about some of the most interesting people we met over the past 12 months. That's pretty easy when you do a program with the word knowledge in the title. This year was better than most. Hey, I got to meet the Fonz.
You know, a kid doesn't wake up in the morning and go, wow, I think I'm going to be an idiot today. I think I'm going to be disruptive today. They can't help themselves.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll listen again to my conversation with Henry Winkler about how he deals with dyslexia. We'll also meet a scientist who practically grew up in laboratories, and we'll have a conversation and an academic minute with one of the world's leading experts on the planet Mars. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Beginning in 1974, Henry Winkler became a household name, starring as Arthur Fonzarelli for 11 seasons on the TV show Happy Days. About midway through that run, at age 31, he finally found out why he had always had such trouble reading and concentrating. He was diagnosed with dyslexia. Now the 71-year-old actor, producer, and author writes books for children experiencing the same difficulties he did while in school. The Hank Zipster series is about a schoolboy growing up in New York with dyslexia. I spoke on the phone with Henry Winkler and later met him in person and talked about what it was like growing up with dyslexia.
Well, you know what happens, honestly, when a child has trouble in school, when a child has trouble, because their brain is wired differently, which is hereditary. But when a kid has a problem, they see that they're having a problem, and their self-esteem plummets. You know, a kid doesn't wake up in the morning and go, wow, I think I'm going to be an idiot today. I think I'm going to be disruptive today. They can't help themselves. And so what you do is you start thinking you're less than. And so, you know, as a parent, I knew once I learned what I had, that I had dyslexia. As a parent, I looked at all my three kids and my grandchildren completely differently. And if you're quiet and you look at your child and you listen to your child, they will tell you what they need from us.
So you came up with Hank Zipster.
I did, with my partner Lynn Oliver. And we just turned in our 32nd novel. And the newest one, Always Watch Out for Flying Potato Salad, comes out on the 31st of January.
And you have an animated series with that too, right?
No, there is a wonderful series, a live-action series. I could not sell Hank Zipser to television in America. So we sold it to the BBC. And it is now a hit on the BBC, and we've completed 3 years.
I always try to look at someone's Wikipedia page and say, okay, I don't believe that, so I'm going to ask you right now. Do you have an Order of the British Empire?
I do. I used to do a play at Christmas time in England, and I traveled all over, and while I was there, I would travel all over England and visit schools and talk to the children about the concept that there's greatness inside every single person in this room that I'm talking to. And your job is to figure out what your greatness is. And I would ask the kids, anybody know what they're great at? And one was great at soccer, and one was great at math, and one was great at drawing, and one was great at science, and one was great at being a plasterer. He was an apprentice plasterer, because I talked to kids from kindergarten to 12th grade. That's what I did. And then the Queen said, I'm going to give you this award because of what you have done for the children here in England.
Well, if you keep it up, you might be Sir Hank one day.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Right now, I'm so happy. I'm blessed with the life that I lead.
Henry Winkler is... Oh, come on, he's Henry Winkler. His latest Hank Zipster book, co-written with Lynn Oliver, is called Always Watch Out for Flying Potato Salad. If anyone has earned the title Lab Girl, it's Dr. Hope Jaron. She spent many days growing up playing in her father's lab at a community college in a small Minnesota town. She has gone on to build several labs of her own, and as a geobiologist, studies trees and flowers and seeds and soil. Hope Jaron is now a professor of geobiology at the University of Oslo in Norway. I spoke to Hope Jaron this year by cell phone back in April about growing up in a lab and how that shaped her future.
Some of my very first memories are being in the lab, what it smelled like, what it felt like, what the machine sounded like, what the glassware sparkled, etc. My father taught community college. He taught at the same community college for 42 consecutive years, and he taught everything from chemistry to physics to earth science, and physics was his true love. But he would go there in the evenings and set up for the next day, and me and my brothers would go with him, and we would take care of the equipment and fix anything that needed fixed and set stuff up and made sure it worked. And I just loved it. I loved everything about it. I loved being there, and my father loved it. It was his favorite place. And so by the time I was old enough to say what I wanted to be when I grew up, I didn't really know. I just knew that I wanted to have a lab, because that's what you had when you grew up, and it was going to be a big lab, and it had a bunch of stuff in it, and we were going to have all kinds of fun doing different things. And that's the one thing I've always known for sure, is that I belong in a lab.
I love your description of your father saying that he was not a scientist in town. He was the scientist in town.
Right. So it was a small town in rural Minnesota, and he taught all the sciences, and he taught people that we knew. You know, your teachers were the same people that had been his students, et cetera. And so his identity in the town was really, you know, he was the guy that knew physics and was ultra patient and loved to teach it to people. And I watched that and I said, yeah, that's what I want to be. That's the thing to be.
When you decided on your field of studying plants and things that grow, you're going out into the great outdoors, yet you still came back and loved working in that lab, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. I like to study plants because it was kind of the hardest problem I could possibly think of. You know, most of physics, things act like they're supposed to, you know, balls roll and pendulums swing and all that kind of stuff. But you get into growing a plant, and most of the time it's not going to do what you want it to do. And then you got to figure out why. And it's a whole different world once you introduce living organisms. And plants are so very different from us. You know, we can't even relate to them like we can to animals in some ways. That it was just the hardest problem I could come up with that would require the most curiosity and imagination and drive to really keep things going. And it's kept me going for quite a few years now.
You write about people not really seeing the plant life and the trees around them. And I've read your descriptions of trees and seeds and big muddy holes, and I don't think I could see them the way you do.
Well, I do this for a living, so I do it day in and day out. And that's one of the benefits, is that I can share things that I've noticed from spending all that time, you know, with people who you don't spend your time that way. You work in a different field, but kind of the magic of what's come to me is that there's a few things you can point out about how trees work or what's outside your window or whatever that, and you see the spark in somebody's eyes and they think, well, I never thought about it that way. And maybe when they walk home, they'll look at the world a little bit differently. It's a pretty lofty goal to try to change the way somebody looks at the world. But if you look at plants and you realize they're all around us, and then you really start to think about how they're alive. They're alive, just like you are. They're trying to do things, and they're trying to stay alive, et cetera. They're different than you, but there's something amazing about when it really clicks in that we're living in a world that's also living. I love to teach that, and this book is a way of sharing that with a bigger classroom in some ways. That's what it's all about.
Hope Jaron is a professor of geobiology at the University of Oslo, Norway. The name of Dr. Jaron's latest book is Lab Girl. It's out in paperback from Vintage Books. Still to come, how much do you know about the planet Mars? This year we met a scientist who probably knows a lot more. We'll hear that conversation again next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. If you want to learn anything about the planet Mars, Dr. Nadine Barlow should be your first call. Dr. Barlow is a professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at Northern Arizona University. She's recently turned her gaze back to planet Earth to see if we can learn something about our own climate from her study of Mars. I spoke with Dr. Barlow this spring and asked her how she got involved in this study and what sent her to Mars.
Oh, boy. I actually got interested in astronomy many, many, many years ago, and it was during the time period when we were first starting our exploration of Mars, our spacecraft exploration. And it was those pictures just really enthralled me because it was the first time we actually had seen Mars as a planet with geology. And I thought, wow, that's really cool. It's no longer just this little red point of light in the sky. We can actually tell something about its history. This was when I was a kid, and I continued to follow and keep track of what was going on. But once I got to college and I actually started doing research in graduate school, my advisor said, well, I've got this project related to impact craters on Mars and what they might tell us about the distribution of water and ice under the surface, and would you be interested in working on that? And I grabbed it, and I've been involved with Mars ever since.
Why is the search? We hear an awful lot about the search for liquid water or evidence of liquid water on Mars. Why is that important?
Well, first off, under the current climatic conditions, Mars cannot have liquid water on its surface. So it's a very thin atmosphere, it's a very cold environment, and so if you put liquid water on the surface, it's either going to immediately evaporate into the atmosphere or it's going to turn to ice. But yet we see a lot of geologic evidence and mineralogical evidence that there is actually large expanses of liquid water on the surface in the past. And in fact, we think Mars may have actually been very Earth-like in its early history. Obviously, something has happened. Something has changed on Mars. And so we'd like to know, what happened to Mars? Could something like that happen on Earth? Could we prevent it from happening here on the Earth? And then, of course, the other issue is that we have a very strong interest in actually sending humans to Mars and establishing colonies. So trying to figure out where the water might be hidden today is important for us to know what resources are actually available to the future colonies that we hope to establish on Mars.
Does this study help us possibly understand climate change here on Earth?
Yes, it does. We actually do see that there is natural climate change on Mars. As I mentioned, early Mars probably was much more Earth-like. But even in more recent times, i.e., millions of years as opposed to billions of years ago, we do see evidence that Mars goes through periods where you get a lot more snowfall occurring down to mid-latitudes, where today it's confined to the polar regions. So if we can look at Mars and also Venus on the other side of us, which has the extreme in the other direction, where you have very, very high temperatures, we can start to get some idea in terms of what are the natural fluctuations that planets go through in terms of climate change. Compare that to what's going on with Earth today, where we're actually seeing big changes in temperature over hundreds of years as opposed to the millions of years that we see on these other bodies. And that way we can get a better understanding of what's the contribution from humans versus what's the natural contribution to global change.
How much functioning technology do we have on Mars right now to help study this?
Oh, quite a bit. We have, of course, two rovers that are operating on the surface of Mars. We have the Opportunity rover, which is our little Energizer bunny, has been going and going and going since 2004. And then we also have the Curiosity rover that's been on the surface of the planet since 2012. And so they're giving us the surface perspective of what's going on, you know, in terms of, you know, atmospheric conditions, dust storms, and so forth. But we also have a number of orbiting missions at Mars. We have the Mars Odyssey mission that's been in orbit since 2001. We've got the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. We've got the MAVEN mission. We've got European Space Agency has a mission called Mars Express. India has a mission in orbit. So there's lots and lots of hardware up at Mars. And in particular, the MAVEN mission is really interesting to us in terms of the issue of climate change, because it's actually measuring how fast the Martian atmosphere is escaping today and can actually extrapolate backwards and figure out how long ago did we have a much thicker atmosphere that could support Earth-like conditions, and how fast is the atmosphere actually being lost today, and what are the processes that, by which it's being lost.
We've heard that they have found evidence of liquid water on Mars. What do we know now about Mars? Just concrete, yes, we know this.
Okay, we do know that there is lots of water ice on the planet. So we have some water ice in polar caps. We have some at the higher latitudes that's right at the surface. But we also do see evidence that there are regions that actually change in appearance seasonally. They darken in the spring and the summer, and then they go away in the fall and the winter. And our, you know, from looking at it spectroscopically, where we can get the chemical information, we have determined that, yes, it does appear to be briny water that is actually seeping out onto the surface. So it does appear that we do actually have liquid water on Mars as well. Most of our models that we look at in terms of, okay, what's the surface temperature and how much heat is coming out from the inside of the planet and so forth, tell us that the liquid water reservoirs are probably on the order of about a mile or so down into the surface. But there may be areas where it's much closer to the surface. So those, of course, are interesting to us, again, for the resource aspect. But also, of course, there's this question of whether or not Mars may have ever had its own life forms. And areas where we can actually identify where there's liquid water and go and explore those in the future will definitely be of interest to us in terms of the question of whether or not life has ever existed on the planet or if it exists there today.
Well, when are we going to get there and find out?
Well, of course, we have a lot of robotic missions going on right now, and they're kind of our robotic geologists on the surface of the planet. We do have a mission that's going in 2020. Right now, it's just called Mars 2020. Not a very inventive name, but someday we'll have a better name for it. But anyway, that mission is actually going to collect samples of the surface and store them on board, and then a future mission will actually come and retrieve those and bring them back to Earth for us to analyze. In 2020, the European Space Agency also is planning to send a mission called ExoMars that's going to land on the surface and actually drill down into the near surface, down to about a yard. And our hope is that those cores that we'll get from that drilling will give us some information as to whether or not there's fossils or life forms, you know, at depth. And then in terms of humans actually going to Mars, that's always a million-dollar question, you know, and, you know, it's more than that to actually send them there. So
it's a several billion-dollar question, yes.
It's at least a billion-dollar question. But there is a very strong push both from the private side now, from companies like SpaceX, as well as NASA, European Space Agency, the Russians, Chinese, India, you know, all the nations are really interested in this. And so there is talk about actually sending humans to Mars in the 2030 timeframe.
Sending them there seems to be not as hard as getting them back, I would
imagine. Yeah. Part of the issue with going with sending humans to Mars, I mean, you know, some of us remember when we had the Apollo missions to the moon and, okay, they go out and a few days later they come back. Well, Mars, of course, is quite a ways further away. And if we launch at a time when Earth and Mars are kind of closest together in their orbits, it still takes on the order of about 6 to 9 months to actually reach Mars. Then once you're at Mars, you know, presumably we're going to want to spend a little bit of time, at least a month exploring and so forth. But then if you hop in your spacecraft and try to come back, it's going to take you on the order of about a year and a half because Mars and Earth have actually moved apart from each other in their orbits. So that's the challenge. You know, how long do we keep the astronauts on the surface? Do we keep them on the surface for almost an entire Mars year, which is about 2 Earth years? Have them do a lot of exploring and then come back in about 6 to 9 months? Those are some of the challenges that are facing us.
Okay, the question everybody wants to know. How accurate was the movie The Martian?
It was actually quite good. There are, of course, a few things that, you know, those of us who study Mars kind of went, you know, that's Hollywood for you. But in general, it did a very good job. Probably our biggest complaint about the movie is the very first scene where you got this massive dust storm that's blowing everything over, and that's what strands them there. Spoiler alert. But but it is a case where the Martian atmosphere is so thin that even with strong winds and the dust storms we do see there, it's not entirely clear that you have enough force from that wind to actually be blowing things over in that manner. So that's kind of the major issue that we have with it. And then, of course, there's little minor things here and there. But overall, it was very well done. I mean, in terms of the scientific accuracy and, you know, possibly being able to survive by planting potatoes and, you know, in the Martian soil and adding nutrients in various ways, you know, all of that was very well done.
So we all can look forward to poop potatoes from Mars.
Something like that.
Okay. Dr. Bartlett.
Well, hopefully we'll have them sterilized a little bit better than that.
But, you know. It would be nice. Dr. Nadine Barlow is a professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at Northern Arizona University. And you haven't heard the last of her yet. Long before I spoke to Dr. Nadine Barlow, she appeared on one of our academic minutes. If only there was some way to hear that again.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella. Volcanic eruptions and nuclear tests are among the most powerful explosions that take place on Earth. Nadine Barlow, professor of physics and astronomy at Northern Arizona University, explains how such terrestrial events provide a key for understanding the nature of otherworldly impacts.
An asteroid hurtles from space and strikes the Martian surface, creating an impact crater. The hit causes a turbulent dust cloud to flow outward, scattering a thin layer of fine-grained material that settles up to 20 times the crater's radius. Winds normally remove this deposit within a few weeks of its formation, but in certain areas of the planet, the deposits somehow resist erosion and survive for millions of years. What's the secret behind their longevity? Our survey of Mars has revealed 140 craters with these unusually thin and widespread deposits. They are associated with small craters found in thick, fine-grained sedimentary deposits, most of which are found in the ice-rich mid to high latitudes. Based on similar deposits on Earth that are formed around explosive volcanoes and nuclear explosions, it is likely they form when material ejected from the crater strikes the surrounding fine-grained deposits, kicking those small particles up into the turbulent atmospheric flow. The resulting dust cloud rolls along the surface, eventually settling around the crater. All impact craters on Mars probably form this type of deposit, and normally it is quickly removed by winds. But those that remain resist erosion due to a thin, salt-rich crust that is formed when water that reaches the surface of the deposit evaporates, leaving the salt layer behind. It's similar to the process we see in dry lake beds in the desert southwest. This salty crust protects the deposit from immediate erosion, making it visible to us even millions of years later. Today, Mars is cold and dry, but the fine-grained, ice-rich sediments tell us that the planet undergoes major climate variations over the span of a few million years. When conditions are right, snow and dust can blanket the mid-latitudes, giving rise to the conditions that create and preserve these types of layered deposits.
That was Nadine Barlow of Northern Arizona University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.